Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. It's an hour of medical news, discussion, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news. A little of this and a little of that today on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. And the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I want to give thanks to one of my dear friends, Dale Owen, for bringing this story to my attention. This is very, very important research and something that many men will want to sit up and take notice about. Men with prostate cancer who take anticoagulants like aspirin, in addition to radiation or surgery, may be able to cut their risk of metastasis by as much as 50%. This just came out in a paper presented at the annual meeting of the American Society for Radiation Oncology a couple of weeks ago down in San Diego, California. The study was a fairly large study looking at 5,000 men with localized cancer of the prostate that had not spread beyond the prostate gland. The researchers looked at these 5,275 men who were being treated with surgery or radiation, and of these, 1,900 were taking anticoagulants for various reasons outside of their prostate cancer, history of thrombophlebitis, atrial fibrillation, or history of heart disease. Of the anticoagulants, we're talking about Coumadin, Plavix, warfarin, and Aggrenox. These are all drugs that are used for various purposes but are in the category of anticoagulant. Turns out that aspirin was the best benefit. And what they saw was that in men who were on anticoagulants, they had a risk of dying from prostate cancer of 4% over 10 years. In the men in this same cohort who had, you know, as far as they could tell, comparable disease, the risk was 10%. So from 10% to 4% with the addition of aspirin, and that's the risk of dying from the disease. The risk of bone metastasis was also significantly reduced. And the idea is that anticoagulants somehow prevent the metastasis. So if you've already metastasized, it doesn't work. But if you haven't, this could be a big deal. Now, an aspirin a day keeps the doctor away is becoming more and more a truism. What with the indications for aspirin for prevention of strokes and heart disease in all diabetics, and now this latest data on prostate cancer, coupled with what we know already about heart disease and stroke, aspirin's looking like a really good substance. Of course, like anything else, it does have its downside, but huge positive and something I'm sure that people will want to know about. I had a question. The exact dose of aspirin for heart disease is 81 milligrams. Stroke prevention typically in women, 325 milligrams. In the case of these prostate cancer patients, some of them would have been on the 81 milligram dose, some on the 325. I'd say go with the 325 dose as far as the prostate cancer metastasis is concerned. I wanted to talk a little bit about what hit the news big time this week, and that was the Institute of Medicine report on vitamin D. I had an email from Eliz in Maryland about it. What she says is, I've managed to get my vitamin D levels above the teens by taking a vitamin D3 supplement rather than the vitamin D2 prescription my doctor recommended for over 2 years. Yes, indeed. That's a problem. Now, with the level in the 40s, my question is, how much should I take daily? And should I get retested ever so often to make sure that it stays there? Well, the answer, Liz, to both of those, as far as I'm concerned, is yes. And Liz goes on to ask about my thoughts that on the Institute of Medicine report. But let me just say that the Institute of Medicine report is coming from an institution which is innately highly conservative. So they have a standard of evidence that is very, very high, which means that you need large numbers and multiple replications before they will accept that something is a true statement. So what they came out with their report and saying is, using their high standards of evidence, that vitamin D is proven to work for the prevention of bone loss. And they also went on to place some new requirements. They essentially doubled the old doses for vitamin D, which for a conservative institution is actually quite a positive step. What I found very interesting was that the media spin on this focused on the high doses of vitamin D are bad. And indeed, what the Institute of Medicine report actually says is that long-term use of more than 4,000 units a day could be associated with an increased risk of kidney stones. That's the extent of the bad. By the way, they also said that long-term use of more than 2,000 milligrams of calcium a day can be associated with kidney stone. And those are both true and well supported by the evidence. At this point, to go back to Eliz's questions, I think that we need to monitor blood levels. The idea that a person should be taking 5 or 10,000 units of vitamin D for prevention of disease without monitoring their blood levels strikes me as just plain uninformed. I will encourage everyone to achieve a blood level of a minimum of 35. And if you have cancer, autoimmune disease, or other dysregulation of the immune system, if there's a family history of multiple sclerosis, then you may want to be shooting for 55 to 65 as your goal level. One accumulates vitamin D in the body. So the way to do this is to achieve a high level using supplementation or tanning beds judiciously, which I think is an option that doesn't get discussed enough because everyone is so freaked out about skin cancer. But I think with moderation and appropriate use, you can get vitamin D with a tanning bed safely. It has to be very small doses, and it has to be the right kind of tanning bed. Nevertheless, oral supplementation is legitimate, and using, say, 5 or 10,000 for a brief period of time to get that blood level up where it needs to be, and then using the minimum level of supplementation, and hell, go with the 4,000 and see if that works for you. To maintain it is an appropriate way to thread the needle here between the very rigorous standard of evidence that the Institute of Medicine has and the very promising lines of evidence that simply aren't large enough studies and haven't been replicated enough, but are nevertheless very promising and suggestive, and which do have a plausible mechanism. And therefore, I think it's legitimate for us to be a little bit further from this Institute of Medicine report in terms of our expectations of vitamin D, but we can still be conservative in terms of our long-term dosing. And I have seen people go overboard with vitamin D, and I've had one patient in particular came in with a level of 110, and I do think that could be dangerous. So let's try to have a little sense in moderation here. I know it's difficult in this black and white world to think in shades of gray, but let's give it the old college try. Lots of interesting emails this week. I want to start with one from Mark in Santa Cruz. This was something I hadn't heard of before. Dear Dr. Don, I have a friend with Lyme disease. She's undergone heavy antibiotics, including a few months on IV, but she's still not getting better. Big red flag there. She's started to look at Rife treatment, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation. It's spelled R-I-F-E. The handful of treatments she has had with a coil machine and a contact machine seem to cause a large Dioff/Herxheimer reaction. Another red flag. She is considering buying one before her money runs out for antibiotics. Parentheses, Kaiser refused to diagnose her with Lyme, so all her treatment is out of pocket via a Lyme specialist. What is your opinion on Rife machines? If you think they are effective, do you have information on what kind is better, coil, contact, e-impulse for self-treatment? And what about Rife treatment for other illnesses? Well, I did some superficial research on the Rife machine, Mark, and it was invented by Dr. Rife, and this is back in the 1930s. It's a very old radio frequency machine, and we now use radio frequency for a lot of medical applications. This one was based on a resonance concept, and the developer claimed that using a very high-powered microscope, and he could see the destruction of certain microorganisms using a frequency that the microorganisms resonated with. And his hypothesis was that each of these microorganisms had a unique resonance frequency, and you could tune the machine to kill these things. And it was initially kind of promoted as a cancer cure and essentially failed to replicate. He built about five of these machines, and then I don't know what happened for about 50 years. And then in the 1980s, somebody dusted off the technology and started making these and selling them. I wasn't able to find on Google Scholar any actual medical research looking at using these machines. And when I tried to search on radio frequency and cancer, of course, I was inundated with surgical data. And that's not what we were after here. We were after, you know, chasing this concept that you're destroying microorganisms with resonance frequencies that are unique to them. I have real serious trouble with the physics here. I have trouble with the mechanism. I have trouble with it not matching the physics of resonance phenomenon as I understand it. And I admit it, I'm not a physicist. So I think it's probably a scam. That's where I would put it right now. I'm not sure that your friend isn't already being scammed. I tend to be very skeptical when people have a quote-unquote Lyme disease and they're seeing a Lyme specialist and they're getting IV therapy and they're not getting better. Given how difficult it is to accurately diagnose Lyme disease, at that point I start saying to myself, what else have they got? Or what do they have that isn't Lyme disease? Because if it's Lyme disease, you should get better with therapy. So that's my primitive understanding of how infectious diseases work. Even infectious diseases like advanced Lyme disease or tertiary syphilis tend to respond to antibiotic therapy, at least while you're on it. So I'm skeptical that your friend actually has an accurate diagnosis, and I'm concerned that the reaction that she had, rather than being a sign that the radio frequency machine is actually doing her some good, is actually a sign that she's massively disrupting her body's energy. Let's call it a toxic reaction, maybe from massive chi disruption from the body radio frequency. I would be really worried about a therapy that makes her feel sicker. I'm not saying this radio frequency is just placebo. It may actually be dangerous. And so I would discourage her from purchasing a machine. At this point, I'm very skeptical about the path that she's on. Sorry, and I hope that's actually helpful to hear, I think, a considered negative opinion. And I hope you know that I am open-minded about things, but this one's past where I think you should go. Let's go now to Kathleen in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kathleen. Hello. And welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi. I'm a 61-year-old person who is trying to sleep. I had my cortisol levels checked, saliva checked, and my cortisol goes up in the evening, or at least it did for that test. And I'm wondering about phosphatidylserine, and if that is something that you would recommend for lowering cortisol, or what you would recommend for helping me sleep.
Okay, this is a big topic, and we won't be able to cover it in sufficient detail, but let me try a little bit for you.
Okay.
First of all, natural sleep cycle is that the cortisol level is highest in the morning when you rise. So between, let's say, 7 and 9 a.m., whenever you're getting up, around that time, cortisol levels should peak. They then should drop in a smooth curve and inflect somewhere around mid-afternoon, and then continue trending down very slowly throughout the night.
Mm-hmm.
When a person has a peak in the evening and their cortisol spikes, that is a distorted biorhythm. And it's probably, unless somebody ran up and said boo at you just before you did the saliva test, it's probably real, and it probably does represent a disrupted cycle.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times people also get a melatonin test at 2 in the morning. Did you do a melatonin?
No, okay. I didn't, no.
So, by the way, that's a useful thing to do.
Okay.
But you don't have it, so we'll work without it. Phosphatidylserine is a compound that is incorporated into the cell membrane of cells, particularly nerve cells. And so it's a membrane component. It's important for healthy nerves. I am not aware of any data showing that it induces sleep, but it is probably helpful for Alzheimer's and degenerative neurological conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would tend to go with a problem like yours is actually to more adrenal support, traditional adrenal supporting herbs, particularly withania somniferum, which is, trying to remember, ashwagandha is the Ayurvedic term for that. Mm-hmm. That one has some good sleep-generating properties. Licorice root, not DGL, which is great for your intestines, but doesn't contain the appropriate component. Mm-hmm. Licorice used judiciously, and be careful with your licorice, because too much will interfere with your kidneys and could cause high blood pressure and low potassium, so you don't want to be overdoing that. But licorice is, used judiciously, a really good drug, and the ginsengs are also good, although you have to be careful with Chinese ginsengs because they can be alerting and you have a sleep problem, so we'd probably want to go with Siberian ginseng for you. And this is not something, as you can see, I'm not giving you doses and I'm not giving you specifics because this needs to be individualized and you should be working with somebody on this. When you're dealing with herbs and you're trying to reestablish body rhythms, there's other things you have to do. You have to do meditation, you have to exercise, you have to have a healthy lifestyle, you have to clean up your diet and clean up everything because you need to get the body back into a healthy rhythm so that you can entrain a healthy body rhythm, and it's all tied together. So it's not like, oh, you go, here's your prescription, go get your herb, take your pills, and all will be well. And we run into too much herb as drug thinking in our culture because we're socialized to think of, you know, taking a pill. I get people coming in, they're on 30 supplements, and it's like, okay, so what is the goal of each of these, and, you know, is there a way that we can do it with food? Food and lifestyle, rather than trying to patch with yet another compound. Sleep hygiene is very important, and as I said, stress reduction is very important, but this is a real issue. It's a real thing. I hope that's helpful. I know it's very general.
Yeah, that's okay. Okay, I was just especially asking about that one compound, whatever it is.
Not on my top 10 go-to things for this.
I see. So it's more like ashwagandha or adrenal support, really.
That's how I've been taught to handle this, yes.
Okay.
And all the other things I mentioned as well.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Lynn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lynn, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. My wife and I went down and visited my daughter down at UCLA this past Thanksgiving, and she just recently got a little note from UCLA saying that all the people that ate at this particular restaurant had been exposed to Hep A. I wanted to get some information about Hep A, and, you know, they said everyone should go in for a Hep A shot, either that or a gamma globin.
Gamma globulin.
So what can you tell me about this?
Okay. Well, there are three hepatitis viruses, A, B, and C. If you get hepatitis, you want to get hepatitis A. Hepatitis A, unlike the other two, is not a blood-borne disease. It's a poop-to-mouth disease. Let's suppose you have a food service worker, and so you have someone who's cooking food, and they come down with hepatitis. That would cause the restaurant to have to report that they had an employee with hepatitis, and therefore everyone who ate at the restaurant might have been exposed. Well, were they really? Well, it kind of depends on whether the employee was obeying the law and washing their hands. If a person who has hepatitis A doesn't poop at work, then there isn't really much chance of having poop on their hands and putting it into the food, and that's all of that needs to happen before you can get the disease. The incubation for hepatitis A is several weeks, so that's why you can outrun it by giving immune globulin. And even potentially using the vaccine, although it's really a race. If a person's exposed to Hep A and you've got, you know, 2 to 3 weeks for the hepatitis A to incubate and it's 10 days before they start making antibody, then you can see how that's really a race to use just the vaccine. In a real exposure, particularly if there have been index cases, in other words, people getting Hep A from the restaurant rather than just the restaurant worker, in that circumstance, I give immune globulin, and that, I think, is a sure way of preventing the disease, but it's a self-limited disease, and you have to ask yourself, well, do I really think I've been exposed, or is this just a precautionary thing? In your daughter's case, the absolute safest thing to do is to get an immune globulin shot and a Hep A vaccine, and I presume those are going to be offered by the student health.
Yeah, she's been in contact with them. I guess they've gotten great deal of calls associated with this. They've had additional telephone lines.
Oh, yeah.
Handled in flux.
Right, because everybody gets alarmed and goes, nowadays everybody goes on Google and says, oh my God, I'm going to get cancer. It's like, No, take a deep breath, back away slowly. It's not like that. Very, very rare does hepatitis A ever cause long-term problems. Very rarely does it cause any kind of fulminant hepatitis. The vast majority of people recover fully, but they're sick for a while. Nasty sick, like a case of mono, a couple months of not feeling well. So it's not pretty, and you don't want to get it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Don.
I hope that was helpful. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Barbara in Santa Cruz. Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm sure you've probably addressed this in your past programs, but suddenly it's become very important to me. And that is, my doctor said that she sees from the results of a bone scan that I have osteoporosis, she says, pretty badly in my spine. I haven't had any other bones checked on that particular scan. It's just the spine and the hips. She says, your hips are fine. They're great. But she says it's definitely in your spine.
Is this the first time you've had a bone scan?
I had a bone scan several years ago where they just did my arm, and that seemed to be fine. I'd say that was probably over 10 years ago.
This is the first time you had a spine.
Yes, it is.
Bone scan. When I see a real dissymmetry between the spine and the hip, I pay attention to that, because a lot of times that means you may actually not have a problem at all.
Oh, you're kidding. Really?
Yeah. It would be lovely to have 2 data points. And so it's going to be a couple of years before you have your second data point. And
right.
In the short term, you're going to have to make a decision about whether to go on anti-reabsorptive therapy or not. So let me just give you a couple of quick thoughts.
Okay.
Bone density is what we can measure, but bone density is not the only determinant of fractures. There is microstructure of the bone, and that tends to vary in some subgroups of the population. So in other words, there are women and men, for that matter, with very low bone density who never fracture.
Mm.
And that's because there's something good about their bones that we can't measure, which is to say the microstructure of their bones keeps their bones from fracturing. So even though they're not dense, they're solid in a different kind of way. They're structurally solid. Think about geodesic domes, right? They're big, they don't use a lot of materials, they're very lightweight, and yet they're quite strong.
Yeah, exactly.
So if the bone is built like a geodesic bone in its microstructure, then it can look bad on a bone scan and still be quite good bone, which is why you look at the family history. If you have a family history of quote-unquote osteoporosis and no one ever breaks anything, and no one gets compression fractures, and no one gets the forward hunch as they age in the family, then it may be that you're one of these outlier groups. In most people, the spine and the hips tend to deteriorate together. So if the hips are great and the spine is, quote-unquote, osteoporotic, I consider that possibly there's something else operative. You also look at lifetime risk factors, smoking, drinking, steroid use. And nowadays, before doing any kind of anti-reabsorptive therapy, we obtain a FRAX score, F-R-A-X. So you should look that up. You can go online, and there is a website that will allow you to calculate your FRAX score. And this gives you your risk of a fracture in the next 10 years. And that's the basis for whether or not you should do therapy.
Okay.
So that's something to look at. How old are you?
I'm 63.
And did you ever use any hormone replacement therapy?
I did briefly. And then when I heard about the
2002,
risk of breast cancer and whatnot, I stopped it. I have an estring at this point, which is very low release of estrogen.
Right.
And I wear that. But
good for the uterus and good for the bladder, but not probably enough to preserve bone. So with only one data point, it would be good to get urine bone breakdown products, which is called a telopeptide, urine telopeptide, T-E-L-O. That test will tell you how rapidly you're losing bone. If you're losing bone rapidly, or you seem to be based on that score, that would tend to tip me in the direction of treatment.
Okay.
Definitely obtain family histories. Talk to relatives, aunts, you know, anyone who's still alive.
Most of those people are gone. And none of them that I was aware of had any osteoporotic problems.
How old did they get to be?
74, 83. One just recently died close to her 90s. One died into her 90s. So
you've got enough data points there to suggest if we'd done a bone scan on them, they might have had osteoporosis of the spine too.
Mm-hmm.
But no fractures and no collapses. So,
no.
So maybe you've got good microstructure.
Okay.
Anyway, it's a possibility. I wouldn't let myself become a PWD, that is to say a person with disease, based just on one DEXA scan?
Thank you. That's the first place you go because it's a little distressing to...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know. And it's
because I'm very active and I'm afraid I'm going to have to start giving things up, and I don't want to.
This may be your last downhill ski race. You know, you may not be able to do downhill skiing racing mm-hmm. anymore. You might have to get off those double black diamonds.
Okay. That's probably good advice anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Also, I have the website for you. My producer has, I should call him Twinkle Fingers. He just pulled this right up.
Oh, great.
It's www.shef.
S-H-E-F.
F as in Frank.
F as in S-H-E-F.
And then .ac.uk/FRAX. And I will post that on the website if you get it. And you could pick it up on the podcast again.
Okay. Could I ask you just briefly about supplementing my intake of taking more magnesium? So
sure.
I take more magnesium and reduce the amount, or quit taking calcium. I've heard that calcium is puts women at risk for heart attack. That's one thing. And then the other thing I've heard about, that's a separate item, but I've heard that you reduce the calcium and take increased amounts of magnesium, which will cause the calcium count in your system to actually go up.
Yeah, it's complicated. It's not, like I was saying to the other person, it's not just, you know, go take this pill and all will
right.
be well.
Right. Oh, I know that, yeah.
Generally, the ratio of magnesium to calcium that is probably ideal is about 1:1. And so increase your magnesium to be taking as much calcium. I don't know what calcium you need. It's going to be between 1,000 and 1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And your vitamin D level needs to be checked to determine how well you're absorbing your calcium. But having enough magnesium, and also there are other trace minerals. Boron is very important. Vitamin K turns out to be very important in terms of bone mm-hmm. mineralization. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things besides just calcium involved in making bones.
Mm-hmm. About magnesium in particular, do you know what the amount of magnesium
is? About 1,000 milligrams spread out over 2 to 3 doses a day is the current consensus. In the alternative world, consensus is just about impossible to find. And in
sure.
the conventional world, consensus is generally 20 years behind the times. So mm-hmm. take your pick.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's pick up with Joan in Felton. Hello, Joan, and welcome to the program.
I just like to know, Dr. Don, I so appreciate your program. I listen every week. And I'm calling today to respond to your response to the person with questions about Lyme disease.
Sure.
I contracted Lyme disease in 1984, and it didn't get diagnosed till 87. And it's just been a hellish journey. I've had, all the tests are positive, and I've also had a positive test for co-infection, Babesia.
Mm-hmm. Which is very common.
Yeah, but they didn't know this back in the 1987. When I started treatment, I was on antibiotics for 5 years, amoxicillin and IV rosefin. Actually, I had it in my joints and knees, but the primary thing was neurological, and the antibiotics seem to chase it away from the knees or get it away, but the neurological symptoms have just remained and progressed. And the truth is that a lot of people with Lyme disease, even with intensive treatment, don't get better.
Well, they may not get completely better, but you yourself have just said some of your symptoms improved with the antibiotics.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the case of the email I read, this person has had no improvement with antibiotics. And that's what calls, in my mind, the diagnosis into question. Plus, she's, a bunch of doctors telling mm-hmm. her she doesn't have it. And so,
well, my I know.
I've heard
symptoms were no improvement except
I
with
got
the
it.
Rosefin.
I got it. The neurologic symptoms are hard to fix because it's hard to get past the blood-brain barrier.
Right.
Right. So, did you have any further commentary? I understand.
Yeah,
it's
the other one
disease.
Was that there was a doctor down in Watsonville who was specializing in Lyme, treating a lot of Lyme patients. Dr. Talty. She has left the area, but she was interested in the Rife machine, and I did go do that, and she actually bought one and was using it,
mm-hmm.
and at first, and maybe it's placebo, who knows, but I felt dramatically better, and then got just worse, and I did it for about 6 months, and then I just gave up on it because she was finding the same thing. Their hypothesis is that the lime spirochete has some way of changing its resonance. Who knows?
Well, you know, that's really far-fetched.
I know.
It's like, excuse me, I mean, on what planet does a spirochete have, first of all, intelligence, and
right.
second of all, changing your resonance? I mean, based on the physical properties and shape of your structure, you can't...
Yeah.
I can't even come up with an evolutionary model where you could select for a different structure or different resonance properties. It just doesn't make sense.
I know. It doesn't really make sense.
And, you know, that's exactly, unfortunately, what placebo looks like. And I'm an acupuncturist, so I get placebo on patients. I'll get people who come in, they've got something that typically takes, let's say, 6 treatments to improve. And they'll come in and they'll call me the next day after their first treatment and they're like, I'm cured. And I'm like, I'm not going to tell them, no, you're not. You're experiencing a placebo effect, because I'm happy they're feeling better and I want them to come back because, you know, after 6 visits, they will probably be better. And if they're not at that point, it's like, okay, this isn't going to work for you. But I just think that the placebo effect is enormously powerful and it's real. It's not some kind of, it's in your imagination. There's actually real healing going on. Somehow by giving our bodies or permission to heal or telling our body that it's going to heal, it goes and does it. And if we could only figure out a way to put that in a pill or bottle it, it would be great. But the characteristics of the placebo response compared to the acupuncture response, because I get to see a lot of both, is that the acupuncture response builds. And so you'll be better for a couple of days and then you'll revert.
Right.
And then the next time you'll be better for 5 days and then you'll revert. And so on. And so the duration of benefit increases and increases. With placebo, exactly the opposite happens. The first time, it's fabulous. The second time, not so much. The third time, nothing. And it's like, okay, that was a placebo response. That fantastic first response you had was you, not me.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to give it to them again.
Right. Well, one of the placebo, I don't know if it's placebo or something else, but one of the things I did when I was just finally, after 10 years, so sick, I quit work and moved to Hawaii, and I stayed there 3 years, and I got better. I actually studied with a Hawaiian healer and took Hawaiian herbal medicines and swam in the ocean every day with dolphins, and I got so much better, I came back. And I've had a lot of other people tell me that they go to Hawaii for Lyme, and maybe it's the more ozone in the air. Who knows?
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I would feel a lot better if I was living that lifestyle.
Exactly.
All right, Jen.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. Let's go to Bruce in Elkhorn. Bruce in Elkhorn.
Hi. Yes, hi. I just wanted, when the placebo effect was mentioned, it seems like it gets discounted fairly quickly, and yet I think it sort of forgets that, you know, our bodies really do the healing, and we may augment that with medical technology, but we don't really cure things with these external forces. That the body, all we're doing is really facilitating what the body's doing. Mm-hmm. And if you think that the negative effects of stress on disease, which so many diseases get accelerated or aggravated or induced by stress triggers, if you think of placebo as a reversal of that kind of stress mechanism, it seems completely logical.
That's an interesting way of placebo response as a reversal of the stress mechanism.
You think of what stress does to disease and the impact. And yeah, it seems, of course, that with our profit-driven medical system that we're never going to really study it in this country because there's no money to be made off placebo effects.
Oh, that's not fair. Come on. No, seriously, that isn't fair. I'm one of the first to criticize, as anyone who's a regular listener knows. I'm, you know, right up there to criticize, you know, the orientation of a lot of our research, which is drug development. Okay, that's where the money is. That's where a lot of the money gets put. But we do have a really good institution in the NIH, and we do have the, you know, the Office of Alternative Medicine, which is actually trying to do decent science and sort through this stuff. And in fact, I was at a conference where one of the representatives actually came to the, it was an acupuncture conference, and made an appeal, you know, please submit research protocols. We really want to do research on acupuncture. And, you know, there's problems with the concept of doing research on acupuncture because of the controls and how you would set up controls. And that's a long topic that I won't get into now. But it's not fair to say that there hasn't been a lot of research done on the placebo effect. There's a ton of research on it.
It seems to be coming out of Europe and Scandinavia more than the U.S.
I don't know. I don't really pay too much attention to the brand of the pure science. If it's pure science, it's all good.
The Swedish government or German government will fund studies that the U.S. doesn't tend to fund.
That may very well be true. I think your idea about the stress response is absolutely true as a contributor to disease. I think that the mechanism of the placebo response is probably more than just neutralizing the stress response. I really do think there's something very mysterious going on, and probably at what I call the energetic level, not the sort of above the cellular level, at the cellular signaling level. So the signal goes throughout the body. Then something happens, and it seems almost magical, but you know what Arthur C. Clarke said about that, right? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic?
Well, so much obviously, even just the effect of inflammation on heart disease is something that's just barely begun to be understood or appreciated, I guess.
Well, not understood. Thank you for your contribution.
Thanks,
and
Dr. Don.
Have a good day.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Judy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Judy, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don. Thanks.
Good morning.
I have a question about interpreting thyroid function tests.
Okay.
Since the beginning of the year, I have had a number of symptoms. I don't know if we need to go into all of them, but anyway, that suggested I might have hypothyroidism. So in July, I had a TSH test that came back 4.2. And according to the standard range used by the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, that is within the normal range. Their normal range is 0.34 to 4.82. Mm-hmm. But when I look on the web, my stepdaughter alerted me to the fact that there's quite a bit of discussion about what is an appropriate normal range. At what point do you start thinking about hypothyroidism?
Yes.
So I look on the web, and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists says the normal range is 0.3 to 3.0.
Okay, before we get into the minutiae here, what's your question?
My question is, what range do you use? Is this American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, is that a legitimate medical body? I mean, is that something that...
Yes, that's a legitimate medical whatever body. I guess that's as good a term as any.
Organization or whatever.
Yeah, they're not selling snake oil or anything. They're for real. Again, you know, we were talking about vitamin D and the Institute of Medicine, and I mentioned that consensus in conventional medicine is by definition about 20 years behind the research. Mm-hmm. So the consensus is that it's 0.5 to 4.5 or whatever numbers. But that's really what everybody can agree that, yeah, it's somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. But in terms of where's the sweet spot, where's the goal, it's narrowing down to around 2.5 to 3 as being, you know, that's what we should use as a threshold to start thinking about treatment.
So 4.22 is perhaps suspicious.
But not to a doctor who's following the party line. And if you're, one of the things that happens is large institutions have institutional cultures, and it isn't necessarily rules that stop your doctor from doing something. It's a culture. And the cultures, the bigger the institution, Kaiser, PAMF, the more of a groupthink there is. And so them's the rules. Those are the range. And if your TSH is 4.2, you probably will not be able to be treated. Now, if you were to go out to, you know, into alternative land, you would find someone who would diagnose you with subclinical hypothyroidism, correctly or incorrectly. I don't know, because you haven't had those tests, and treat you for that. And who's to say who's right? And I guess the answer is you need to feel better and feeling healthy. And then at that point, I guess that's what's right for you. But too much thyroid is bad for you and kind of jazzes you up, but it all helps you lose weight, makes you feel perky, but it also melts your bones. So there's a downside to overtreating with thyroid. Like the whole Suzanne Summers, you know, take tons of estrogen and feel great and get breast cancer kind of paradigm. It's like, let's not go there.
Okay. There's two little follow-up questions. One is, I did have a second test done as a follow-up, and it was from 4.22, it went down to 1.7. Is that a usual range of variation, no, or is there something suspicious about that?
Well, that is not a usual range of variation. I have seen people get a virus that infects their thyroid, and their thyroid kind of lies down for a while and doesn't work well. Their TSH goes up. You say, oh, you're hypothyroid. And then a month later, you check it again, and it's back to normal, and meaning that the thyroid just went on strike and then came back. So I don't know. That's weird. I think if you've got those two numbers, you need a third number for a tiebreaker.
Okay, so at that same time that the second test was done, because I have severe rheumatoid arthritis, we also did a thyroid peroxidase antibody test, and that was within the normal range, well within the normal range.
Okay.
So it means that the thyroid peroxidase...
means that you don't have antibody, yeah. You don't have that antibody against your thyroid.
Right, right.
I think you just need to get a
further test.
Just
should I do?
Okay, so in a month or two, mm-hmm. another TSH... a free T4, which will give you your unbound active T4 level,
okay.
a total T3, and a reverse T3, which you will not have heard of, but when you get those numbers, you can call me back and I'll help you interpret them, okay?
Okay, very good.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye. Let's talk to Betsy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Betsy. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my situation is, scalp has been like itching and burning for like 3 days. You know, looking at it, it's not red or anything. It just really itches and burns. And then I started yesterday, my forehead started itching and burning. And then I realized last night when I was sleeping that, you know, I thought this was really limited to my scalp. But I realized that for a while now, I wake up in the middle of the night and I find myself scratching my arms or my legs. And then I go back to sleep and then it doesn't really bother me during the daytime. But I'm just adding that piece because
okay.
It might not just be my head.
So you've thought this through on new shampoos, hair color products, new soaps, nothing like that, right?
Well, yes. I switched the shampoo about 3 weeks ago. I switched to a shampoo given to me by my hairdresser and it was fine. But just in case, for the last 3 days, I haven't used it.
I think that you're switching shampoo and then getting the itchiness is certainly suspicious. It's circumstantial,
uh-huh.
but the timing works for me. So you may
3 weeks.
Oh yeah, you need to look at the ingredients list on that shampoo,
okay.
and make sure you copy down all the ingredients.
Okay,
and then you will make sure that the substitute shampoo you do the same thing and you compare ingredients and the things that are in uh-huh. the hairdresser shampoo that aren't in the one that we hope isn't bothering you in the future. Are things you're potentially allergic to. That could be the easy fix. The other possibilities, but since you have some generalized itching, although it mm-hmm. sounds pretty mild, the other possibility would be new drugs or new foods.
I'm not doing any of that.
Okay.
I don't take any medication at all.
Yeah, and I'm pretty suspicious that it's the shampoo, that there's
okay.
just something in that shampoo. So what I would do is get your doctor, call in, see if you can get them to prescribe a mild cortisone lotion. You can rub it into your scalp. 1 or 2%, I usually use 2.5% cortisone, which is a prescription. You rub it into the scalp, it kind of calms it down, helps reduce the itching. Benadryl or diphenhydramine at a children's dose can help with the itching if you really
uh-huh.
need that for sleeping, and then ride it out. You could be looking at another month.
So just switching to a shampoo that I think is, you know, whatever, I mean.
Switch to something like Johnson & Johnson baby shampoo or something
okay.
that's really has a low amount of antigens. There's probably,
okay.
you know, Tom's Natural, whatever. I don't know. But
okay. But it can take a while.
It can take a while to damp down, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I'll give that a shot. Thank you.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to take the last bit of the program to just talk a little bit about HIV. Because when I first started medicine, there was this funny disease that no one knew anything about that was hitting gay men, and it was completely unidentified, except that it was an immune system collapse. No one knew how it was transmitted. When these men would come to the hospital terribly ill, they'd be put in total isolation. Everyone would wear bunny suits and masks, and it was horrible. It was horrible because of the fear that they engendered. The behavior of the medical personnel taking care of them was not always exemplary. I saw some people lie there in pain and no one would go in and help them because they were afraid of being infected with this mysterious plague that destroyed your immune system. Later on, we understood how the virus was transmitted. That helped a lot. But people still treated people with HIV and with AIDS like lepers, would refuse to touch them, would refuse to let them sit in the same classroom with their children. And that sort of behavior goes on even today, although much, much less than it was for a long time. In the meantime, a great push went on in scientific labs all over the world, and efforts coordinated by the UN. A great deal of effort has gone into trying to stop the rise in HIV, and that actually just happened. The rate of increase, for the first time ever, new AIDS cases dropped 20% over the last decade. That is huge. We have hit the inflection point on this. Prevention is actually starting to work. Last week, we talked about the research looking at Truvada, which showed that people who take it to prevent HIV don't catch HIV. If they take it every day, it's at least 70% effective in preventing HIV. And of course, we also had an announcement from the Pope saying that, you know, come to think of it, using a condom is a lesser evil than infecting someone with HIV. So a small chink in the armor there, a good thing. And I am just really proud of us. I think we can look upon this. It's a victory. It's a bumbling victory. And yeah, sure, we could have done better, could have been better, could have been faster, could have been a stronger response. But it also could have been an unmitigated disaster, and it hasn't been. And I am, for one, very grateful to everyone who has participated in the fight against the spread of HIV/AIDS. And I think we should just take a moment and take our hats off mentally and applaud that we've actually turned the corner on something really, really important. And we've come to the end of another hour. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week. In the meantime, so long and stay healthy.